When the president escalates the war in Afghanistan, the fighting will be done by U.S. soldiers and Marines paid by the taxpayer. But they'll fight and eat and sleep outnumbered by private contractors.
Omar Sharif, CEO of Ujigas, the Ujigastani conglomerate. Terminate. Do that voodoo that you do so well. This is a historic moment, Hauser. The first war ever to be 100% outsourced to private enterprise.
War, Inc. is one of those movies that's only funny because it leans so uncomfortably on the truth. In a corporate age, we've privatized war. And not just the laundry, even some of the shooting has been outsourced. If you want answers, should you call your congressman or go to a stockholders meeting? Follow the money, if you can. It's on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 4th, and up from Washington, Todd Zwillick is with us. He is filling in for the five-time expectant father, John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Five-time champion, John Hockenberry.
Right.
On the show today, we'll have details about the unemployment numbers that come out at 8:30 this morning, and the president visits Allentown, Pennsylvania. We'll talk to the mayor, but first, let's check all of the day's news to get you going this morning.
The surge of troops heading to Afghanistan is growing. This morning, NATO pledged 7,000 more troops in support of the new U.S. strategy. And there may be more to come, with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Brussels to try to coax more troops out of Germany and France. Meanwhile, we're getting new details about the U.S. strategy itself. Defense Secretary Robert Gates told senators the withdrawal of troops will likely take 2 or 3 years, and there are no deadlines for when all the troops will be out. Gates also said he's received approval for as many as 3,000 support troops.
Where I have asked the president for some flexibility is in medics, in intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, in counter IED capabilities.
Now, those numbers don't include the tens of thousands of military contractors already on the ground in Afghanistan, a number that's sure to rise as the new buildup strategy is implemented in Afghanistan. For more on that, we're joined by Robert Young Pelton. He's former advisor to NATO in Afghanistan and an author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. Robert, private military contractors were criticized for not being accountable in Iraq. Haven't we seen this movie before? Is there any more accountability in Afghanistan than there has been since 2003 in Iraq?
Well, they've got stronger contracts, but contractors have become smarter in how to do their things without getting into a lot of oversight. So they're getting smarter, and we just have to try harder to watch them.
They're getting smarter about hiding where they spend our money?
Yes, they're getting smarter in all ways. So it's a very advanced and a very mature business now.
All right, trying to keep our eyes on the strategy and also trying to keep an eye on how private contractors are spending our money in the war. Robert Young Pelton, stay with us. We'll talk more in just a few moments.
Across the border in Pakistan, the White House has approved a plan to step up drone attacks against Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders. Our partner, the New York Times, says the attacks may be conducted outside tribal regions for the first time. And also in Pakistan, two suicide bombers stormed a mosque close to the army's headquarters in Rawalpindi during this morning's prayers. They opened fire and threw grenades before blowing themselves up, killing at least 35 people. Coming up this hour, we're going to speak to Janet Napolitano. She's the Secretary of Homeland Security, and we're sure to ask her about the threats coming out of Afghanistan and Pakistan as this surge moves forward.
November unemployment numbers come out in about 30 minutes. Economists expect the jobless rate to rise slightly or hold steady at 10.2%. A jury in Italy has retired this hour to consider the verdict of an American woman, Amanda Knox, accused of murdering a British student 2 years ago. She maintains her innocence. Wall Street is waiting to hear those unemployment numbers. Futures are down slightly, and the Dow will open at 10,366. The S&P opens just under 1,100, and the NASDAQ is at 2,173. The Nikkei rose for the fifth straight day in Asia.
Coming up later this hour, we're going to talk movies because it's Friday, and we have a trivia question for you. You've got the rest of the hour to think about it. Not counting the new release, Everybody's Fine, name three other movies that Robert De Niro has starred in that are remakes. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also call us about unemployment in your town and the social safety net. What does it look? The view from the street in your hometown. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. It's Todd Zwillick here filling in for John Hockenberry, who's at home welcoming his newest child into the world. And I'm here with Takeaway host Celeste Headley.
Good morning.
You might call American military contractors the absent presence in President Obama's speech on Tuesday announcing his new strategy in Afghanistan in the buildup. There will soon be 100,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, but they'll be outnumbered by private contractors. It's not just the number of contractors that has a lot of people concerned, but it's the accountability about what they're doing and how they're spending our money. Who are they? Where's the money going? And can we check up on them? Well, joining us to talk about it is Robert Young Pelton, back with us. He's former advisor to NATO in Afghanistan and author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. Also joining us is Allison Stanger. She's a professor at Middlebury College and author of One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. Robert, I want to start with you. Most of us remember Blackwater. We might remember KBR from the Iraq War. What is this, beyond just security details, security that we may have heard about in Afghanistan, what's the scope of contracting work in Afghanistan now? What do they do?
Well, the major difference is that you have a lot more reconstruction, or actually construction projects, infrastructure, roads, schools, things like that, governance, and less actual security contractor work. And that's because of the environment in Afghanistan. Most of the security work is actually handled by Afghans, sort of brokered through either Western or Afghan companies. But what you're not seeing is this huge support mechanism for intelligence gathering, for support of troops, even movement and mobilization of troops. And, of course, the CIA, with their sort of secret war in Pakistan, extensively uses contractors to conduct drone attacks, intelligence gathering, and things like that.
And because that mission is clandestine by its very nature, we're extremely unlikely to know what the private contractors are doing.
Well, you'll find out about it because they work with Afghans, and Afghans are chatty fellows. So folks like Eric Prince think that they keep secrets, but most people know what his company's doing over there.
Allison Stanger, I want to ask you, how accountable are military contractors? Accountable at all? War is, by definition, murky business. When the money starts to flow to private companies who have proprietary interests, is there any way we can find out whether they're spending our money in the way we want?
Yeah, well, there's a great way you can find out. You can go to something called usaspending.gov, which is available at www.usaspending.gov, and it's available because of legislation that President Obama pushed through as a center. It'll tell you everywhere all you need to know about prime contracts. But the problem with Afghanistan is that most of these contracts are turned around and then doled out as subcontracts,
right?
So the things Robert's talking about.
You can find out the top lines where the prime contractor is, but then once they spend it on whoever they're hiring, whether they're Afghans or more Americans, it gets murky.
That's right, and it's shrouded in secrecy. That information was supposed to be available to the public by January 1st, 2009. But if you go to that website and click on subcontracts, you'll find that it says it's under construction.
Now, Allison Stanger,
that's something that concerns me.
Well, in terms of accountability, Allison Stanger, let me ask you about the Armed Contractor Oversight Directorate, part of the Pentagon, and they, as far as I know, are tasked with keeping an eye on where taxpayer money is going in the military. But I understand that a lot of their work for oversight is outsourced.
That's correct. I mean, we're currently in a situation in both Iraq and Afghanistan where the work of contractors is actually overseen by a contractor.
Is there anything more to this than just bitter irony? I mean, my question is this. The fact that taxpayer-funded oversight inspectors general are not doing this down to the level of some subcontractors, is that something to be concerned about?
Well, Secretary Gates has even referred to it as willy-nilly contracting. And I think what you're seeing is that there was this mission to be accomplished. It was huge and ambitious. And so we turned the Pentagon turned to contractors to execute it as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And we're only now beginning to see what the consequences of that sort of strategy brings.
Well, Robert Young Pelton, former NATO advisor in Afghanistan, you mentioned that a lot of the contractors that we hire now are Afghans, both for security and for other contracting work. And I want you to listen to something that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said before the Foreign Relations Committee yesterday, asked about this, that we're outsourcing work to Afghans, and that's a good thing because we want them enrolled in what we're trying to do. But it can also have complications. Listen to the Secretary.
Much of the corruption is fueled by the money that has poured into that country over the last 8 years. we are so dependent upon long supply lines, as we are in Afghanistan, where everything has to be imported. You offload a ship in Karachi, and by the time whatever it is, you know, muffins for our soldiers' breakfasts or anti-IED equipment gets to where we're headed, it goes through a lot of hands.
Robert Young-Pelton, it goes through a lot of hands. The Afghans, the way they do business traditionally might not be the way we're used to doing business in the U.S. Is this a concern?
Yeah, it goes bigger than that, though, because, for example, in Afghanistan, if you're a soldier and you need an interpreter, they bring an American Afghan and they pay him $960 a day to interpret for a $1,200 a day U.S. contractor. So when the Afghans are being accused of corruption, they point to things like that and say, you're stealing all the money before it even gets to us. So it's not just a matter of people taking bits and pieces from sort of the friction of spending money there. It's our ridiculous idea that we're going to hire people for $150,000 a year to supervise Afghans who make, you know, $400 a month.
And then where does the rest of the money go? That's Robert Young-Pelton, former advisor to NATO in Afghanistan and author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. We were also joined by Allison Stanger, professor at Middlebury College. She's author of One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. Thanks to you both for joining us. And now at 13 minutes past the hour, here's some of the headlines we're following this morning.
Local police in Pakistan say at least 40 people have now been killed in a suicide attack on a mosque this morning. The attack involved two men near the headquarters of Pakistan's army in Rawalpindi. The mosque is attended by military officers. The NATO chief says member countries will provide around 7,000 new troops for the American-led mission in Afghanistan. He was attending a NATO meeting in Brussels, also attended by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. A jury in Italy has retired to consider a verdict in the trial of American Amanda Knox. She's accused of murdering a British student in Italy 2 years ago. Knox has denied any involvement in the death. A correspondent for the BBC in Italy says much of the case rests on disputed DNA evidence. And the film director Roman Polanski, who's wanted in the U.S. for having unlawful sex with an underage girl, has been transferred from jail to his Swiss chalet after he posted bail. He's not allowed to leave until the Swiss authorities decide whether or not to extradite him to the United States.
Back at home, an Oregon couple who went on the hunt for the perfect Christmas tree ended up stranded in the snow for 3 days, stuck on a remote road out of cell phone range. It took a helicopter and a rescue team to track them down. Safe at home, Keith Lee says he's going to add a few more items to his Christmas list this year.
I think I want a flare gun, a snow shovel, and some real shoes.
Is that your Christmas list?
That's my Christmas list now.
And a GPS, maybe. The couple did find their prize tree, a silver-tipped fir that only grows at high elevations. The prolific songwriter Aaron Schroeder has died. You may not be familiar with his name, but you do know his work. Schroeder wrote over 2,000 songs, including the Scooby-Doo theme and this Elvis Presley hit.
It's now or never.
Aaron Schroeder worked with Jimi Hendrix and Barry White during his career. He was 84 when he died. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, we'll talk with Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano about what's at stake in the Afghan war. And later this hour, we preview the upcoming World Cup. That conversation is coming up in just a few minutes. The World Cup draw, where ping pong balls are actually taken out of a fishbowl to decide who plays where.
And we're also asking you for your spin today. Tell us about the economy in your area. We're talking a lot about the social safety net and the holes that have appeared in the social safety net in the aftermath of the economic downturn. What's it look like in your hometown? Are there holes in your social safety net? And how is the unemployment numbers that we're going to expecting out in just a little short while, 15 minutes or so, how does that play out in your hometown? Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hey, you want that to go?
And we have some quick takeouts now on stories that we're following this week. We have Louise's story from our partner in the New York Times. And we also have Todd Zwillick, but he's not joining us from Washington. He's across the desk from me today, filling in for John Hockenberry, who is expecting at this moment John Hockenberry Part 5, the fifth member of a young member of his family. But Louise, let's go to you first. Good morning. This is a story that merges finances and journalism in a disturbing way.
It's tearing my gut out, actually.
The A.H. Below Corporation that publishes the Dallas Morning News and, right, and a bunch of other papers sent an internal memo to their employees. And basically what it said is that some section editors are now going to report to the sales department, not an editorial department, the sales department. Why is this a business story?
Well, traditionally, the business model of newspapers and a lot of media companies has been that the news side, you know, the editors, the reporters, they focus on the readers. They focus on what the content is that people come and want to read. And the business side focuses only on the advertisers, on selling ads that will run alongside the news. And what this memo was talking about was kind of crossing that Chinese wall and having the editors talk with the business people more about what sort of news content they should be doing to draw readers.
Now, we have been watching, people say that we have been watching the deterioration in that firewall between journalists and the profit model of news for some time now. And as a journalist, I got to say, this is alarming, that as a journalist, I don't want to have to worry about who my funders are or whether we're pleasing the major corporations which are buying ads in the paper.
Might be unethical for you to even think about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
That's right. So, I mean, the issue is, will the business side be pushing for more of the content to be stuff the advertiser would like? Or the other argument is, maybe the business side will be pushing for the readers. You know, one thing, if you look at a lot of newspaper companies, as advertising revenue goes down, the circulation revenue, the revenue that comes from readers, is actually going up. And a lot of media companies are focusing on charging for their content on the internet in the future, which means that the business customer for media companies is becoming the reader more and more, not as much the advertiser, which is an argument for having the business side involved, but it's a really slippery slope. It makes a lot of journalists very uncomfortable because this is not the way it used to work.
Well, that's one way, Louise, to try and put my fears at rest. But, you know, here's the problem. If you are an editor and you are going to a sales meeting and the sales meeting says, look, we just got this ad campaign from a major, food company. And how can we tie this in with stories? How can we find some stories that would tie in with this new major campaign, right?
Well, so that's the concern. But Jim Maroney, who is the publisher of the Dallas Morning News, did a bunch of interviews yesterday because people in the media world were very nervous when they saw this memo. And he said that the purpose of this is to help design products for readers, to just talk about what type of content you might want on cell phones. And actually, that's not all that different from something that's been happening for decades. If you think about the fact that newspapers always have sections, they have the sports section, the business section, the living section. And you know why they have, you know, a house and home section in some papers? It's because they can sell house, you know, furniture ads. And so it's a little artificial to say it's ever been completely separate because there is always a relationship, but people are very nervous about the model, and they're very nervous about spoiling the purity of journalism.
One quick last question for you, Louise, story of the New York Times. Are we expecting to see more of this as newspapers are trying to find a way to survive? Are there going to be more announcements like this?
We've seen some other examples. I don't know if you remember, but the LA Times moved the Sunday magazine that it publishes to its business side in 2008, but then that was very unpopular, and there were concerns, and they moved it back this year. So this is going to be a testy balance. Newspapers are looking for all kinds of ways to make money, so we'll have to watch.
Okay, that's Louise Story, our finance reporter for the New York Times. Thanks so much, Louise. Another story that everyone is watching and has been watching for some time is healthcare reform, and we're staying connected to people who are actually using the healthcare system right now. It's via a project called The Waiting Room. It interviews people at Highland Hospital. It's a county facility that often treats the uninsured in Oakland, California. And we wanted to check back in on this project and hear from some of the people who are showing up there at Highland Hospital. This is Chris Regulon. He had plenty of time to share his story because he went in there to treat what he thought was gout in his foot and leg, and he needed it examined.
I don't have health insurance. I'm unemployed, and I really have no way to cover myself, so I wind up having to come all the way out here because it's county health. This is the closest hospital that'll, you know, do anything for me. It was actually a pretty quick day. I've only been here for 6 hours, and just basically a lot of pain in my foot, and they took me in. They poked around with some needles and stuff and determined that I didn't have what they thought I had, and they aren't really sure what I have, so they send me home.
Well, 6 hours in the waiting room didn't seem to bother Chris. That might be because some of the other patients said they waited up to 14 hours. Mm. They sit patiently because chances are it's the only chance they have. Most people in the ER waiting rooms are uninsured, using emergency rooms like a primary care physician.
I got a brand new heart valve. Thank God for Highland Hospital. Helped me out. There's a lot of people that need help like me. I'm not the only one. Everybody here needs help or they wouldn't be here. We all can't afford the insurance and we all don't work because of medical conditions. I didn't even know I had a bad heart 6 months ago. I didn't know I was a heart patient. I hope just to get better, go back to work.
Well, we hope you do also. We're going to be checking back in on this project, The Waiting Room, regularly to see who's waiting for health care as the nation waits for health care reform. And you can find out more about this project, The Waiting Room, and see video interviews at thetakeaway.org. And you can tell us your own waiting room stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. How long do you wait to see a doctor? How long would you wait? Would you wait 14 hours and then maybe get sent home with no treatment at all? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we talk with Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano about what's at stake for Americans in the Afghan war. That's in a few moments, but first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. November unemployment numbers are due out from the Labor Department any moment now. Economists expect the jobless rate to rise slightly or hold steady at 10.2%. We'll be talking to University of Maryland economics professor Peter Morici in the next half hour. That comes as House Democrats are considering tapping billions in unspent dollars to help boost job hirings. They want the money to go toward high-rate construction, teacher salaries, and small business loans. Right now, the law calls for any unspent money to go toward the national debt. And Wall Street is waiting on those November unemployment numbers as we are. Futures are down slightly, and the Dow's going to open at 10,366. The S&P will start out at just under 1,100. The NASDAQ at 2,173. European markets are down in midday trading. Gold fell $11 after yesterday's all-time high.
New information this morning about the war in Afghanistan. NATO is pledging to send 7,000 more troops with a possibility of more to come. This comes as Defense Secretary Robert Gates said the withdrawal of troops will likely take 2 to 3 years. We're also learning more about Pakistan's place in the new war strategy. Our partner, the New York Times, says the White House has approved a plan to step up drone attacks in a larger part of that country, and for the first time, the attacks may be conducted outside of tribal regions. Staying in Pakistan, two suicide bombers stormed a mosque close to the Army's headquarters in Rawalpindi during morning prayers. They opened fire and threw grenades before blowing themselves up, killing at least 40 people. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
New attacks are being plotted as I speak. This is no idle danger, no hypothetical threat. In the last few months alone, we have apprehended extremists within our borders who were sent here from the border region of Afghanistan and Pakistan to commit new acts of terror.
That was President Barack Obama this Tuesday during his primetime address talking about the security of the American homeland and what's at stake in the war overseas that he's just escalated. And there is one person who is tasked with preventing those attacks on American soil, and that's Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have to ask you about the comments that the president made during his speech on Tuesday, because he did talk a lot about how the Afghanistan war was tied into our security here at home. Can you tell us a little bit about what stands out to you as the biggest danger?
Well, out of that region of the world is where al-Qaeda activities are centered. It's not exclusively there, but obviously that's where they do a lot of their planning, their organization, their training. And so what stands out to me is that now we are getting American citizens who have traveled there and been trained and returned back to the homeland. And, you know, that really was part of the significance of the Zazi case when it came to public light.
That would be Najibullah Zazi.
One of our own citizens doing
right.
this.
That's Najibullah Zazi, the 24-year-old Afghan-American who's was suspected of planning to blow up parts of the New York subway system. What kind of things do we have as options in order to find the next plot, homegrown plot, coming from someone like Najibullah Zazi?
Well, I think we can do everything possible to mitigate risk. Part of it is individuals taking some responsibility on the see something, say something, and knowing whom to say it to. Part of it is increased information sharing on intel that we get, and particularly sharing with state and locals and back from state and locals, particularly, say, for example, from your own police department. And part of it is working with our international allies.
Madam Secretary, this is Todd Zwillick. The president the other night announced his buildup, but then also announced a drawdown of U.S. troops, of course, and your colleague, Secretary Gates, says that could take 2 to 3 years. But implicit in that is that this is about terrorism and preventing terrorism. So if we're going to draw down Afghanistan eventually in, let's say, 2 to 3 years, the backstop of that is that Homeland Security must be strong enough to prevent the next attack. You know, we can't kill, nor will we try to kill, every terrorist. So where are we at in that transition right now? As the end of the war hopefully is in sight, do you think the homeland is well positioned to prevent terrorist attacks, whether they be homegrown or from Asia, as the Afghan war draws down?
Well, I think we're well positioned, but let me go back to something I said earlier. I don't think we can rely on one federal government department to take care of all of our security needs. It is going to be a shared responsibility across the country. And if there's anything I hope to work on and improve over the next several years, it's that notion of shared responsibility and really having everybody lean forward into this.
And Janet Napolitano, Secretary of Homeland Security, you came to that position from your position as governor of Arizona, and you're talking about shared responsibilities. And one thing that I know you saw in Arizona, probably any governor sees this, is that departments don't always share responsibilities. In fact, even within your own department, we've seen some highly publicized, I would say, bickering between the CIA, the FBI. How can you resolve these problems among other departments when you're having some kind of cross purposes within your own?
Well, listen, first of all, let me just be clear. The CIA and the FBI are not within the Department of Homeland Security. But, you know, it's complicated because you've got huge departments, peopled by very committed and trained men and women trying to do very difficult jobs. And of course there are going to be some differences of opinion. And of course some of those differences from time to time will come into public view. But that should not detract from the fact that by and large these departments not only get along, they work alongside each other day in and day out. And, you know, without going into details, that would not be appropriate in a radio show, but still, I think there's a lot of work that's being done that the American public probably isn't even aware of.
So let's talk about the borders. Earlier this week, you said your department is going to miss a 2012 deadline to screen the cargo ships that enter the U.S. Through the waters.
Scanning is a term of art, not screen, but go ahead.
Okay, well, explain that difference there.
What I shared with Congress is something that my predecessor shared, that every expert in the security field has shared, which is that 100% scanning does not equate to 100% security, and that we are going with a risk-based approach, really focusing on where cargo comes from, who's handled it, how convinced are we of the security of the shippers. You know, that sort of layering approach is much better than having one area in one port, which, by the way, in the 700 ports around the world, you don't have cargo that just moves through one area, where you do screening and scanning.
You know, that's a kind of a delicate balance there, these kind of issues that you're talking about, because you want everyone to have an easy trade relationship with the United States. At the same time, you want to emphasize security. And it goes back to what you were talking about earlier in terms of personal responsibility, watching what's going on in our own neighborhoods and local police departments watching and reporting and cooperating. How do we maintain that balance between our normal everyday lives, not watching our neighbors through our curtains, not reporting on each other, at the same time that we stay secure and safe?
Well, we've already seen examples of it where civilians, having reported things, have prevented bad things from happening. And I think I'll adopt the rule of common sense. Let common sense prevail.
Let's talk about immigration, because this is definitely part of your department and something that you have a lot of experience with coming from Arizona.
Indeed.
And you have said, first of all, that you support the president in the idea that a legalization path is the first pillar of reform.
Well, and when I say legalization, first of all, I don't say it's the first pillar of reform. I say it's an essential part of reform, which includes giving us some more enforcement tools. For example, our remedies against employers who violate the law are woefully inadequate. Secondly, dealing with future flows of workers, how many are going to be let in the country, under what circumstances, how long will they be allowed to stay? And then thirdly, you've got the millions in the country already illegally. They've got to get right with the law. They've got to come out of the shadows. They've got to pay their fines. And there has to be a process by which they can do that.
And what kind of process are you thinking about for them? Are we talking about legalizing them all in one sweep, getting them through a process while they're here, or do we need to send them home and make them reapply for a visa?
Well, I think we're working on several options. Obviously, this is for the Congress to ascertain, but the notion of deporting them all and then bringing them back, that somehow they'll volunteer to be deported and then come back, is not realistic. And I say this as a border prosecutor and a border governor. So you've got to look at some options that are better than that.
This issue, some people were surprised at how volatile this issue has been over the past year or two. I'm certain that you weren't, considering your experience, as you said, on a border state. But, you know, you're dealing with, we hear stories right now about Sheriff Joe Arpaio in southern Arizona and going out and doing pickups of immigrants there, and a lot of anger and protests going on in Arizona. How do you deal with this issue when there's, number one, a lot of misinformation out there, but there's also a lot of emotion?
Well, I think what you have to do is understand and respect the emotion, but also understand that the emotion is not going to solve the problem, that we have an immigration system that is very out of sync with the 21st century. We have an immigration system that needs to be improved in any number of ways. We have an immigration system that can be improved, and that's going to require Congress to be willing to deal with that emotion that's out there and deal with it by countering it with facts and with action, and that's what we're asking the Congress to do.
You also said that one of the approaches to reform quickly is to regulate the flow of immigrants. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by flow is how many visas are permitted from any area of the world in any one year and for what purpose. Part of that's family unification, which is very important. Part of it is certain worker needs.
You're not talking about maybe putting quotas on how many people come in?
No, but there are caps. And there are caps in the current law, but they are, they need to be adjusted in light of the modern day labor situation. We want to protect American workers, but also looking at our future labor needs.
Okay, that's Janet Napolitano, Secretary of Homeland Security. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. I'm here with Celeste Headlee, of course. It's Movie Friday, coming up in just a few minutes, a discussion about three new movies out this weekend. Right now, here's a check on the leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The Labor Department has just released the November unemployment figures. The jobless rate dropped from 10.2 down to 10% last month, much more than economists predicted.
What does that mean? Joining us is Peter Morici. He's an economics professor at the University of Maryland. The jobless rate drops to 10% in November. Employers shed 11,000 jobs. That's the fewest since December of 2007. Peter, is this good news?
Well, it sure appears to be so. With the jobless rate coming down, we have to recognize, though, that a lot of people left the labor force as well. They got discouraged and quit. The number of marginally attached people, people that are not actively looking but would like to start looking if they thought things got better, went up again. So it's a mixed bag. But on balance, it's much better news than we expected and should have a positive effect on the markets today.
And any idea, this was a larger drop than we expected, as you said. Any idea what caused this?
Well, it seems that there was a lot of growth in the service sector. I would bet, if we take a hard look, we're going to see a lot of part-time employees there. Folks, businesses are trying to avoid paying fringe benefits. But the good news in that context is the number of part-time workers who stated they wish to work full-time didn't change very much. So on balance, this was a very good report. It indicates we're likely to stop bleeding jobs by, say, January, February, as opposed to March or April. The recovery is moving along, not as strong as we'd like, but it's there.
Peter, what's the trajectory here? Now that the rate has risen, now dropped to 10.2%, are we confident that it now continues to drop, or could it be just a dip and it goes back up?
No. We had a big jump last month, and this is monthly data, and by its nature is erratic. 3% growth, which is what most economists are expecting in 2010, is simply not enough to bring the unemployment rate down unless we have another kind of bad news, and that is that productivity growth slows or people just quit looking for work. Those are both bad things. the economy normally has 2% productivity growth, 1% labor force growth. That means you have to beat 3% to really have a healthy job market.
But, you know, if this is all service sector things, as you posit that it may be tied to that, we also heard a lot of retailers saying that they were not going to be hiring a lot of extra help over the holidays. Is it possible they were not correct? Is it possible?
Oh, no, they're not hiring. Retail employment was down. It was in the business and professional services where we saw an up. In healthcare, education, places like that. No, retailers aren't hiring. Retailers are learning how to sell the same number of goods as last year. Sales are hardly up. I mean, there really hasn't been a boost in retail sales with many fewer people. Part of that is, hey, Circuit City closed, so Best Buy does all the business. They didn't hire as many people on as Circuit City laid off.
But doesn't that argue that perhaps this some of this could be a permanent change for the better, that if these are not in the kind of holiday temporary areas, that maybe this will stick around?
Well, these are seasonally adjusted data to accommodate that. What I'm saying is that you can't create a trend. You can't draw a trend with monthly data based on 1 month's decline. It's not the time to pop the champagne. You have to remember that the weekly jobless claims, the new unemployment claims, remain above 450,000. A healthy economy is somewhere between 3 and 350. This number cannot be seen in isolation from other numbers. Now, I don't think that we can say that the unemployment rate's headed down just yet.
I'm hardly a Pollyanna, but we have seen the new unemployment claims drop for 5 weeks in a row.
I know, but 450,000, and that's what we expect. We expect the job losses to slow and then to go away. The question is, will the unemployment rate go down? You have to remember, the economy adds about, 1.4 million people a year, because there's about 140 million people employed. You have to add that many jobs just to stay even.
A dash of realism and a look at the numbers from Peter Morici. He's an economics professor at the University of Maryland. Again, responding to the news from the Labor Department that the November unemployment figures, the jobless rate dropped to 10% last month. That is far more than economists had predicted.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
That's movie music. It's Friday, and it's time to talk movies on The Takeaway. And that means Rafer Guzman, he's here to give us the down low on the new movies coming out this weekend. Rafer, two big films coming out this weekend, some in limited release, some in wide release. You have Brothers with Natalie Portman and Jake Gyllenhaal and Tobey Maguire. That's out in wide release. Up in the air is George Clooney, of course, with Nets in limited release. And I want to talk about Brothers first, a war film.
A war film, yes. It's about the war in Afghanistan, tangentially. It's with Tobey Maguire. He plays a Marine who goes to Afghanistan.
A gaunt Marine. In the trailers, he really looks gaunt and skeletal and haunting.
Well, certainly when he returns from Afghanistan, he's presumed dead by his family. It's Natalie Portman plays his wife. Jake Gyllenhaal plays his sort of ne'er-do-well brother, Tommy. He's presumed dead. His copter goes down in Afghanistan, but in fact, he's been captured by the Taliban. And when he comes back, he's essentially a changed man, and he's starting to wonder what exactly it was that happened between his brother and his wife while he was gone.
And she's rebuilt her life in his absence.
She's tried, and there has been a certain closeness between her and the brother, although, that relationship doesn't go quite as far as Sam thinks it does.
I have to say, one of the things that was striking just about seeing the trailers, and I've seen the trailer a couple times, is that Jake Gyllenhaal and Tobey Maguire look like brothers.
Yes, they do.
They really do.
They do, yeah. They do a really good job of it.
I thought it was a double role at first, that you had one guy playing,
Right. There's some really good things to be said about the movie. The acting across the board is pretty good. I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal, I think, is tremendous. You know, I mean, just like he did in Brokeback Mountain, he takes this secondary role and essentially turns it into the lead for the whole movie. And, you know, just the things he can do with his face and his eyes alone, I think, are really incredible.
All right. Up in the air is George Clooney's new vehicle in limited release. Let's listen to a clip from it before we talk about it.
You got to fill me in on the miles thing. What is that about? Are you talking about, like, frequent flyer miles?
You really want to know?
I'm dying to know.
I don't spend a nickel if I can help it, unless it somehow profits my mileage account.
So what are you saving up for, Hawaii? South of France?
It's not like that. The miles are the goal.
You're saving just to save.
Let's just say that I have a number in mind and I haven't hit it yet.
What's the target?
I'd rather not.
Is it a secret target?
It's 10 million miles.
Okay. Isn't 10 million just a number?
Pi's just a number.
Well, we all need a hobby.
Rafer, is for George Clooney, is this movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Please tell me it's not The Men Who Stare at Goats, because I saw that and I regretted it.
Yes, a little disappointing, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little.
This is actually a really good. This is the kind of stuff that George Clooney does best. You know, these kind of glitzy, glossy comedies where he can play this really charming leading character. That's Anna Kendrick, who we're hearing in that clip,
right.
The young actress who's had some bit parts in Twilight, the Twilight movies, and really gets to step out into the foreground in this movie, and she's really good and really fun. The person I was actually most impressed with in this movie is Vera Farmiga, who plays his romantic interest, and she is, I think, just in looks and her, you know, statuesque bearing, she's really his equal in this movie,
worth
and
seeing.
She's fantastic. I think it's worth seeing.
Let me ask you quickly about Everybody's Fine. This is Robert De Niro as a widower father,
right?
With the co-star again. Remind me,
it's
Drew Barrymore.
It's Drew Barrymore, right. Kate Beckinsale, Sam Rockwell, who's fantastic. Yeah, he plays a widower who's essentially he breaks the number one rule of parenting, which is never drop in on your growing
right.
children unannounced. And this is what he does, you know, trying to reconnect with his kids across the country and paying them surprise visits as he goes along.
And Robert De Niro as a tortured widower and a father trying
lonely.
To get back with his kids as a lonely man. Does
yeah.
he pull it off?
Yeah,
he does. I mean, I wasn't that thrilled with the movie overall, but the acting is really good and De Niro is really good. And again, Sam Rockwell as his son, who's he's a little disappointed. And they have, I think, one of the best scenes in the movie. That segment with the two of them is really the best.
That's Rafer Guzman. He's the Takeaway contributor and film critic for Newsday.
We asked you earlier about our trivia question to name, setting aside Everybody's Fine, the new one, name three films that Robert De Niro starred in that were remakes, and we'll just throw out, there's been several of them, but we'll throw out three of them. One was Heat, another one was We're No Angels, and the third one, Todd?
That's the only one I knew, Gregory Peck in Cape Fear.
Right. If you've missed the latest news, the Labor Department has just released the November unemployment figures. The jobless rate dropped to 10% last month. That's much more than economists had predicted. And employers shed 11,000 jobs. That's the fewest since December 2007. That might be good news for some people. But what about you? Tell us, have you seen the unemployment story play out in your own town? And what about your social safety net? Is in helping out your neighbor, what's helping you out? Are there holes in your safety net? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you've missed anything, we are always on here at The Takeaway. You can take the podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org. And there's also a blog post from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen about Tiger Woods being our last perfect athlete. Ibrahim wants to see this entire controversy die down so we can move on to the next phase. Take a look at that at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Todd Zwillikin for an expected dad, John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway. Good morning. It's Friday, December 4th. I'm Todd Zwillik, in for John Hockenberry today.
Good morning, Todd.
Morning, Celeste. Just in this past half hour, the unemployment rate fell to 10% last month as employers cut the smallest number of jobs since the recession began 2 years ago. The Labor Department says the economy shed 11,000 jobs in November, 100,000 less than the amount of jobs lost in October, and much better than the 130,000 Wall Street expected.
So joining us for more on that story is David Leonhardt. He's a financial writer and columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you?
What are we to make of this? The unemployment rate dropped to 10%.
Well, one of your producers called me at about 8:31 to read the numbers, and I was so surprised that I was sure that he had made a mistake.
You said, you're wrong. You lie.
For sure there was a missing zero in the job loss. It's really good news. I mean, a job loss of 11,000 is just so much better than we expected. And you should always focus more on that net number of jobs than the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate is volatile. It has some statistical quirks in it. So it's good news that the unemployment rate dropped, but I wouldn't pay too much attention to that. It's really this change from, as you noted, more than 100,000 jobs lost in October to only 11,000 lost in November. It's the smallest loss in 2 years.
Okay, so does this mean we hit the bottom and now we're bouncing back up?
Well, we don't know for a few reasons. One, it's just 1 month's report. 2 months ago, we had a pretty disappointing jobs report that looked like job losses were picking up again, and it now seems pretty clear it was a blip, so this could be a blip too. I would be surprised if we're going to get an improvement, a net improvement of 100,000 jobs every month from
okay.
here on out. And the second thing is that, you know, this is still a bad bad number. The real benchmark shouldn't be zero. The real benchmark should be something above 100,000. That's how many jobs we have to create each month just to keep up with population growth. So we're still a ways from good, but we're a lot closer than we were recently.
Okay, thanks so much. That's David Leinhardt. He's a financial writer and columnist for our partner, The New York Times. We're going to talk more about this all hour on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
So those numbers on jobs and unemployment rate of 10% may be a silver lining, but the dark cloud is still there with over 15 million people out of work. If part-time workers who want full-time jobs and laid-off workers who've been looking for work are included, the so-called underemployment rate is still above 17%.
We're taking a look all morning at how, even with positive unemployment numbers, the social safety net is being taken away from people across the country. We're going to start with Arizona at a grim milestone there. 10,000 children have now been turned away from an assistance program there. We're going to talk to also California Congresswoman Barbara Lee about the president's job summit.
7,000 new NATO troops will join the U.S. surge in Afghanistan. NATO chief Anders Rasmussen says more troops may join them in the coming weeks.
If this international effort is to succeed, and it will, it must be a true team effort.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who's also in Brussels, is hoping to get a commitment from Germany and France for additional troops later on. We're also getting new details about the pullout of troops from Afghanistan. The Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, told senators yesterday the withdrawal will likely take 2 or 3 years, and there are no deadlines for when all of the troops will be out.
And Wall Street is rating for a rally on the better-than-expected unemployment numbers. Futures are now up over 100. That's a big turnaround, and the Dow is going to open at 10,366. The S&P will open just under 1,100. The NASDAQ at 2,173. The Nikkei rose for the fifth straight day, but the index in Hong Kong dipped, and European markets are down for midday trading. Gold fell $11 after hitting an all-time high yesterday. Our ears, though, are on the ground. We're taking in those unemployment numbers and asking you, how does that play out in your own town? Are there signs that things are going well where you are, or signs that they're still not so good? And how about that social safety net that we're talking about all this hour? Is it helping out you? Is it helping out your neighbor? Or are there holes in your social safety net? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to get more snapshots on unemployment from all around the country. We'll go to Georgia and Connecticut in just a few minutes. This just in, we got the new unemployment numbers for last month, and the unemployment rate fell to 10%. That's as employers cut the smallest number of jobs since the recession began 2 years ago. We're going to be talking about this all morning long, about how even with positive unemployment numbers, the social safety net has already derided so much that there are holes there already that will have to be repaired. These positive unemployment numbers provide cold comfort to the millions of unemployed or underemployed. Here's the president speaking about jobs yesterday after his summit.
With 1 in 10 Americans out of work and millions more underemployed, not having enough hours to support themselves, this is a struggle that cuts deep, and it touches people across this nation.
We all count on certain safety nets in our lives. Unemployment insurance is one of them. You lose your job, and while you're waiting to find a new one, you'll at least have that unemployment check, right? Maybe not.
This is Chrissy from Miami, Florida. My company closed down last year, October 1, and I've been unemployed since. I'm going to lose my unemployment benefits.
So in addition to the people who are losing unemployment because they've been employed unemployed so long, there are also many states where unemployment funds are running out of money. We're joined now by Carl Gazzardi, the tax director for the Connecticut Labor Department. Carl, can you give us an idea of the magnitude of this problem in your state? How many people are on unemployment or collecting unemployment checks right now in Connecticut?
Currently, we've got well in excess of 100,000 workers, former workers filing claims for benefits on a weekly basis.
Okay, so we're also joined now by Helen Newborn. She's the director of quality employment at the Ford Foundation. The Ford Foundation is pledging $80 million to try and help states overhaul their unemployment systems. And we also have Michael Thurmond with us. He's the labor commissioner in Georgia. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Helen, explain to me that the Ford Foundation has been known for giving out smaller grants than this, maybe $500,000, $250,000 here and there, lots of smaller grants. But this is one huge grant that you're giving out. And I have to think that there's something that came across your desks there at the Ford Foundation that made you think that this problem is so difficult that you have to have this kind of large initiative.
Well, we're very excited about the large initiative, but it isn't one grant. It's a package of grants.
and it's across a set of issues. Our goal here really is to be supportive, more supportive of low-wage working families and help them get the economic stability and the opportunity they need to move forward. Now, clearly, unemployment insurance is one huge piece of this issue. So one of the large grants we just made to the National Employment Law Project is designed to help to put that help into the states. So what's happened is that Congress put $7 billion into this recovery,
right,
and that's available to states that modernize their laws. But a lot of states haven't modernized. If their laws are not modernized, very often they're not serving more than 30 or 40% of the people who lose their jobs. So the goal of this first piece of money is to help states bring their laws up to date, to modernize their systems. They will then get this recovery money. So that'll be money that will come from the federal government into the states to help them pay for unemployment for more people. So the reality is that only half of the workers who are losing their jobs are getting unemployment. So our first goal is, again, to modernize these laws in all the states so that more of these families can get that support.
Well, let's go to Georgia, which is one state that actually has worked to overhaul the system. Michael Thurman, good morning.
Good morning.
What have you done? You just heard Helen talking about the $7 billion from the government to do what you've done there. How have you used that money?
Well, from the stimulus package, we actually improved our system by allowing more UI claimants to receive training for longer periods of time. We already had an alternative base period, which allowed low-income workers to qualify at a higher period of time. But even prior to the recession, we made some initial and critical investments in our IT system as well as in our reemployment efforts that, in this very critical time, has allowed us to serve an ever-increasing number of citizens. One thing, our trust fund has been stretched to the max as well, similar to Connecticut. These are unprecedented times, and quite frankly, these systems were not necessarily designed to deal with the type of unemployment we're seeing at the state level in Georgia and across this nation. That is why we're seeing such a huge impact, not only on the funds themselves, but on the system throughout this nation.
Well, actually, Carl Gazzardi from Connecticut Labor Department, these systems were mainly designed decades ago, half a century ago, to deal with men who are out of work and help them support their families. And some of them haven't been updated since then. So how could you use the stimulus money? What can you do in Connecticut? What do you need from the Ford Foundation funds or from the government to help you improve?
Well, similar to what's been enacted in Georgia, we also in Connecticut had an alternative base period for computing benefits. We've added provisions that would expand benefit eligibility so that Connecticut actually was eligible for the full distribution of modernization funds from Congress and in fact, received those funds. We've used those funds not only to continue to pay benefits, but also to modernize our existing systems, both our telephone systems and our Internet systems for filing claims so that at least the claims process is much more efficient than it was in the past.
So I think these are excellent examples of what can happen in states that are taking this recovery money. But part of what Ford is doing is helping. There are at least 15 or 20 other states that have not done that. And as you've described, the way people's lives have changed over the last 50 years means that so many families are left out of the unemployment system. People who work part-time very often can't collect if they get a new part-time job. Again, if you're training for a new job, you can very often not collect unemployment in a lot of states. So all of these modernization efforts that we'll be supporting with our grantees will make the 15 or 20 states that haven't done this get up to speed and get modernized as well.
Okay, we heard from Carl Gazzardi, the tax director for the Connecticut Labor Department, and Michael Thurman, the labor commissioner of Georgia. Helen Newborn, let me end with you. You're the director of quality employment at the Ford Foundation. You know, we're talking about improving the unemployment system at this point, but for some people, this is a year or two too late. There's already people who are facing tragedy in their own lives, disaster in their own lives, because those unemployment checks already ran out. I mean, many of our social safety nets, as I was talking about earlier in the hour, have already broken.
Well, I think that's a huge problem. One of the other parts of this large grant will also be to support states to modernize their general government support system. So there are other opportunities out there to help families that are struggling, either in low-wage jobs or who've lost jobs, things like food stamps or health care for children. And these benefits also need to be modernized. And so we'll be working with states to try to change those systems so that the application process is quicker and so that families are more able to get benefits. benefits. But I think the bottom line is the only thing that's going to change now is if we get more jobs. I think we're all very interested in what's going on in the job summit and are very hopeful that the president and the country are going to be able to identify additional ways to create jobs. Because the bottom line is that jobs will put families to work. The families want to work, and that's what's going to make the system function.
And that's the takeaway from Helen Newborn, Director of Quality Employment at Ford, the Ford Foundation. They're trying to help states overhaul their unemployment systems, and I'm sure she's heartened by the news from the Labor Department that the unemployment rate across the country actually dropped. We'll check in on stories now. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
As we've been hearing, the unemployment numbers for November came out in the past hour. They show a drop from 10.2% nationally to 10%. The Labor Department says the economy shed 11,000 jobs last month, the fewest number of job cuts since the recession began, and far fewer than predicted. And staying on the subject of jobs, the president hits the road today to talk about creating jobs and the economy. He'll be in Allentown, Pennsylvania. The president will speak at a community college and talk to local residents. Earlier this morning, we spoke to Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. Responding to President Obama's new Afghan strategy, the secretary said her department is, quote, well-positioned to prevent terrorist attacks from inside or outside America. She clearly supported the president's surge policy and called for a better relationship with neighboring Pakistan, where al-Qaeda's leadership is thought to be based. Secretary Napolitano said shutting down al-Qaeda in the region will directly impact security here at home.
That's where they do a lot of their planning, their organization, their training. And so what stands out to me is that now we are getting American citizens who have traveled there and been trained and returned back to the homeland.
Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano speaking to us earlier.
Coming up, what's going to happen with all the GE jokes on the show 30 Rock now that NBC is primarily owned by Comcast? We're going to talk about the business of TV in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning. It's Todd Zwillick sitting in for John Hockenberry. It's time for some takeouts on some of the quick stories we're following today. The Labor Department has just released the November unemployment figures. The jobless rate dropped to 10%, down from 10.2. That's much more than economists predicted. And employers shed 11,000 jobs, the fewest since 2007. Now, it's more than economists predicted, but not necessarily more than Dan Gross predicted. He predicted on this show the other day that the job market might start to recover in early part of 2010, so they might have beat him by a month or two. Dan Gross is a columnist for Newsweek. Dan?
Hi.
How are you? What's first of all, did you nail this prediction, or you consider yourself lucky?
I would say lucky, but I think the underlying trend is that the consensus of economists and analysts out there have not been accurate in terms of the strength of the economy. They've under-predicted the strength. They thought we were going to continue to have more recession when we started to have growth in the third quarter. They've been predicting that we're going to have more job loss when, in fact, those job losses were going down. If you look in the press release from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it shows not just that 11,000 jobs were lost in November. When you're dealing with a data point of 130 million, that's basically flat. I mean, the difference between that and a gain of a few thousand jobs is really nothing. But they also looked back and said, in September and October, we didn't lose as many jobs as we thought we did. And when you look at the services sector, which is the overwhelming part of our economy, 112 of the 130 million jobs are in the services sector. That sector added jobs in November, and looking at their revisions, it added jobs in October, just a few thousand, but that's two straight months of jobs growth in the area that is where most people work.
All right, Dan, we just heard from a listener on this. I want you to listen to what one of our listeners has to say about the job recovery.
This is Ben on the road outside Detroit, Michigan. I just heard those employment numbers, and I got to think that a lot of what's behind those numbers is service industry. I work in a movie theater, and we pick up people around the holidays all the time. But I think the real test will be whether or not those numbers hold after the first of the year.
All right. Well, he raises a good point, Dan. I just said job recovery, and I jumped the gun. It's certainly no indications that it's a recovery yet. But what do you think about that? Jobs in the service sector?
Yeah, well, there's always a certain amount of seasonal hiring, right? People, retail stores hire. There's a lot of activity that goes into these calculations. Now, the difference between this year and last year there was no seasonal hiring whatsoever. This year there is some evidence of that. One of the things people always look to in these numbers is temporary help, because companies frequently, before they have the confidence to add a full-time employee. They will kind of hire temps.
They kind of toe the water a little bit, as it were. Yeah.
Those numbers, there was significant growth in temporary jobs in October. I believe it was 57,000 or so. Again, those are not the jobs that people want. They'd much rather have a full-time job, but you typically do not see a recovery in payroll jobs until you start to see increase in temporary work, and we're definitely seeing that.
So we see those early signs, and of course one month of a drop is not a trend, but any sign of what the trajectory is here? And we've already said we're in a technical recovery out of the recession, but what are the chances that this number jumps back up to 10.1 or 10.4 at some point in January, February, March?
I think, you know, there is great potential for sort of bumpiness in this. We always used to think that when you had an economic recovery, you know, when the factories started to back up and companies would recall their laid-off workers, that employment would return to its pre-recession levels. What we've seen over the last two recessions and what we'll probably see over this one is that, you know, it doesn't quite happen like that. There are structural changes going on. You know, we continue to lose manufacturing jobs, not because the economy is shrinking, but because manufacturing is, you know, going to different places in the world. So right. That underlying trend continues. And until we have, I think, a strong belief among kind of corporate executives that the recovery is here, it's here to stay, and it's durable, they will be very reluctant to hire people.
All right, a little bit of silver lining in the job numbers today, but a lot more confidence to build before the recovery starts. Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek, thanks for joining us.
Our last takeout comes from you, the listeners, and your solutions to the jobs problem. President Obama held a summit about jobs in Washington, and we were on the takeaway having our own jobs summit. While the president had economists and union leaders, we have you. Marguerite says she's a retired professor of social welfare. She emailed us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. We need a huge public works and human services jobs creation program on the order of the New Deal, Marguerite says. Yes, we'll have temporary deficits, but people who are working will be able to make purchases and pay their rent or mortgages. At the same time, we don't draw on unemployment or other welfare benefits. Plus, our infrastructure gets fixed and we can truly move towards a greener economy.
Well, there were others, though, that were just looking for a solution to a very personal problem. That's finding a job.
This is Jeff Houston. I'm calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I did retool. I went to the railroad school in Kansas City, and the economy went in the tank right after I graduated from the school, and I've never worked for the railroad. So it just depends on what you do to retool.
And Jeff called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So if you can't find a job near you, what about bringing yourself to a job? We asked, how much are you willing to change your life for a new job? On that point, Michelle emailed us, I just moved my entire family from San Francisco Bay Area to Michigan for a great job. People keep asking why I would do such a thing, but for us it means better public schools, greater financial stability, a bigger house, and no earthquakes.
Congrats, Michelle. We hope your kids learn to love the Midwestern winter. It's long, though. You warn you, it's long. In warmer climates, Ariel, a 23-year-old from Miami, writes, I just graduated from a 5-year neuroscience program in Boston, and I haven't found anything for the last 7 months. I've sent out at least 150 applications in the last 5 months. Now I'm going to South Africa to follow my dream to a research job. What about you? How much would you change? How far would you move in order to find work? Let us know, or anything else on your mind or in the news at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Of course, we're talking all morning about unemployment stories from around the country, but we need your eyes. Tell us, how have you seen unemployment play out in your town, in your family, and in your community? People go through bad or maybe better times. What about the social safety net? Is it helping you or a neighbor? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We've got California Democrat Barbara Lee joining us in a moment.
Good morning. It's Todd Zwillick here filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, Arizona denied its 10,000th child from a program to help parents pay for daycare. We go to cash-strapped Arizona to see how poor families are bearing the brunt. That's later this hour. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 31 minutes after the hour. In the past hour, the job market showed the best improvement since the recession began. The unemployment rate fell to 10% last month, down from 10.2. The Labor Department says the economy shed 11,000 jobs in November. That's 100,000 less than the amount of jobs lost in October, and much better than the 130,000 Wall Street expected. It could be that we reached the bottom or just a blip on the radar. It's too soon to tell, especially with over 15 million people still out of work. If part-time workers who want full-time jobs and laid-off workers who've given up looking for a job were included, the so-called underemployment rate is still above 17%.
Not surprisingly, markets are up, slightly up, on the news coming out of the Labor Department. Wall Street is bracing for a strong open. The Dow is up 90 points, NASDAQ up 31, and the S&P is up around 7. And the news about unemployment numbers have rippled overseas as well. European markets have bounced back since the news broke last hour. Gold futures, though, slipped nearly $15 after yesterday's all-time high. This comes as House Democrats are considering tapping billions in unspent dollars to help boost job hirings. They want the money to go toward highway construction, teacher salaries, and small business loans. Right now, the law calls for any unspent money to go toward the national debt. More now on a story we talked about yesterday. The attempt to poison the Asian carp before the fish reach the Great Lakes is coming up short so far. Environment officials poisoned a waterway near Chicago two nights ago to prevent what they called an ecological disaster that killed thousands of fish, but so far, only one dead Asian carp has been found. That's a look at some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Well, we just heard the new monthly unemployment numbers for the month of November. The jobless rate dropped to 10%, down from 10.2, and employers shed 11,000 jobs, the fewest since December 2007. And of course, unemployment numbers are bad for everyone. But in Washington, the Congressional Black Caucus has some special concerns. Unemployment numbers are far worse in the African American community, at least 15%, if not higher. Joining us is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She represents California, but she is also the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus. Congresswoman Lee, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Yeah, I'm glad to be with you.
Congresswoman, of course, the Congressional Black Caucus has been having a bit of a clash with the White House over how to handle unemployment in the black community. But before we get to that, I would like you to put your face and your numbers on how unemployment and the faltering economy is affecting the black communities that you and the other CBC members represent.
Sure. Let me say that I don't believe there's been a clash with the White House on any issue. We're working with the White House to try to address these huge disparities in terms of unemployment, health care, education, all of the issues that historically we've had to address in the African American community. We have an unprecedented opportunity now to really help turn this around and ensure that there's equal opportunity for all. So I want to reaffirm the fact there's no clash with the White
House.
There
was some tough talk from your colleague Maxine Waters the other day, but tell us first.
Let me say we're working with some new ideas that we're putting forward, and we're asking all who have the influence and power to accept these ideas that are new. We want change. And so we're talking with the White House and with our leadership about some of our ideas on how we want to move forward to ensure the economic security of the African American community. When you look at, as you said, the unemployment rate, over 15% in the black community, that's just outrageous. And that's those who are being counted. When you look at our young people, the unofficial unemployment rate is about 40%. I think the official unemployment rate is 29%. When you look at the fact that these financial institutions targeted minority communities. They targeted the black community and the Latino community with these scam subprime loans. Then it's very important for us as members of the Congress and as members of the Congressional Black Caucus who represents these constituents to find ways, new ways, to try to help turn this around.
Now, as you try to find those new ways, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus, the next opportunity to do this will be the financial regulation overhaul bill. You mentioned predatory lending and some of the predatory practices that affected the black community. The other day, as that bill was being marked up in committee, several of your members of the Congressional Black Caucus walked out of that vote. And as Maxine Waters said to us the other day, enough is enough. She's saying there will be demands for the African American communities that you all represent on the floor. What are you all looking for,
well,
and how is this going to come to a head?
First of all, this bill is moving to the floor, and the members of the Financial Services Committee have made a major impact in terms of adding good provisions to this bill that would help the bills focus more toward those on Main Street rather than Wall Street. So it's important to understand that the members on that committee did a fine job in making sure that bill.
But they're looking for a lot more, though.
It's addressed clear, in a big way.
It's clear they're looking for more.
Let me just say, we have a jobs bill coming up.
Right.
And as chair of the Black Caucus, I appointed a task force on jobs. What we are looking at now is, again, creative ways, new ways to address the unemployment rate in the in our communities of color, not only the Black community, the Latino community, the Asian community, every community that has high rates of unemployment. It's our job to be that voice of conscience and to come up with new ways to do this. For example, we're looking at job training in this bill. We want to make sure that constituents, people in our country who have never had the education and training and the requisite skills required for these new technological jobs and for instance, in the green industry, we have to have people trained for those jobs. Industry is going to be creating those jobs. We're working with the administration on federal funding to create and to spur investment for these companies.
Are you going to push to have U.S. funds, Treasury funds deposited in minority-owned banks? That they made a big deal out of that the other day.
It's very important to understand that taxpayer dollars went to bail out Wall Street, bailed out big banks. We have to ensure that there's parity and that there's equal participation in our TARP funding and in all of our federal dollars by everyone, by minority banks, by small banks, by women-owned banks and businesses. And so what we're saying is there must be a level playing field. We cannot use taxpayer dollars to only infuse capital into the large financial institutions. You must do this with our smaller institutions, and we have minority institutions that are as capable and as qualified to lend to small businesses which create jobs in communities of color. And so we want some parity and equal opportunity there, and that's what we're talking about. And I think that the numbers show that the statistics show that the TARP funding and also much of the economic recovery funding has not trickled down yet to those institutions which are on the ground and which will help spur the economy. I mean, we're all in this together, so we have to have minority institutions at the table just as other institutions are.
Well, that's your takeaway. We're all in this together, and as the economy affects the entire nation, the Congressional Black Caucus is looking for more focus on African-American communities and African-American banks and financial institutions. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus, who represents California, thank you so much. There is, of course, that financial regulatory overhaul bill that's coming to the floor next week, and some of the members of Congresswoman Lee's Congressional Black Caucus are threatening to make that bill difficult to pass if some of these concessions for minority-owned banks and minority-owned communities are not made. So we will see how that turns out. Coming up, what happens if you can't afford child care, another part of the economy, and the state can't afford to help you out either. We'll go to Arizona, where these are all problems, for that story later on this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. It's been a week since Tiger Woods drove his car into a fire hydrant and then a tree in his neighbor's yard. Has it been that long? But the commentary, gossip, and conversation about his personal life shows no signs of waning. And it's not just here in the United States. The BBC's global interactive show World Have Your Say featured the Tiger Woods saga yesterday and got comments about it from all over the world, like this one from Mumbai, India.
Tiger Woods is the world's best golfer, and he has every right to be questioned over his ability on the golf course. What he does in his bedroom, I don't think should be a matter of speculation.
Madeline Morris hosted that show yesterday, and she's with us now. Good morning, Madeline.
Hi there, Todd.
Well, what did you learn with this discussion, more than sort of prurient interest in Tiger Woods' private life? Is there worldwide consensus about whether Tiger's life is any of our business off of the course?
Do you know, Todd, that's a really tough question, and I think that the answer is probably no, because it doesn't matter which part of the world you live in. There are people who agree that celebrities and sports people have a right to a private life, and there are people who don't. I mean, just an example of some of the comments we got yesterday, Andrew in Australia said, Woods may be the richest sports person in the world, but by his actions, he's not worth very much indeed. He set himself up to be better than most, but that image was only a smokescreen. And this is from Crispo in Uganda. He says, Tiger should know that his business is everybody's business. Doesn't he make his money from his many adoring fans? And so lots of people were talking about that, actually, Todd, the fact that he's such a well-known sportsman. He's joined that very rare group of people who are known by their first name only in the sporting field, and the fact that he makes so much money from endorsements.
Not just endorsements, but he makes so much money from really a squeaky clean 100% pure image, which of course isn't realistic, but this is part of the whole package now. A transgression is highlighted. People seem to understand that.
Absolutely. And people feel as though that's part of the thing that they were buying into. You know, maybe they bought those Gillette razor blades, or maybe they bought that Nike golf wear because they were trying to buy a little bit of Tiger. And Tiger's not only his golfing prowess, he's his squeaky clean image, his beautiful wife and his two clean-cut kids. There were people, though, who were asking why the BBC was bothering to talk about this. This was from Ukunade in Nigeria. There are lots of pressing issues to discuss, like the World Cup draws, the state of health of the Nigerian president. So why worry yourself with the private life of a golfer? What he did might be wrong, but it's not for any of us to judge. I'm not entirely sure that everyone would agree that those two topics are deserving of the world's attention.
The point being from your listener there is that there's other important things to worry about. I want to turn to Samuel from Sierra Leone, one of your listeners. Let's hear from him directly.
I don't know Tiger very well, but I don't think Tiger has ever pretended to be a saint. I want to state here that it's the media that has blown this thing out of proportion.
Madeline Morris, Tiger never pretended to be a saint personally, but his benefactors and his marketers certainly did.
They absolutely did. And we'll wait to see, Todd, exactly how that plays out over the next couple of months.
Well, do you expect to have another show on this, or do you think it's done for your show?
I think that we got a pretty good response on this. We might move on to a few topics, a few more ones that might affect people's lives every day.
All right. Madeline Morris is host of Thursday's BBC World Have Your Say. She joined us from Bush House in London. Her show, like our show and like so many shows, polling the country and polling the world on Tiger Woods, his apparent transgressions, but more importantly, what this says about a marketing conglomerate that was Tiger Woods. What happens to an image that's perfect when we find out that the person who holds it up isn't perfect anymore?
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Todd Zwillick. Todd is filling in for the expectant father, John Hockenberry, expecting at any minute, literally, his fifth child. Coming up, we're going to go to Arizona. Picture this situation for just a moment. Someone lands a new job, and they go to get child care so that they can take this new job, only to find out that the state does not have any money to help them pay for child care, and then they have to turn the job down to stay home to take care of their kid. That's the situation in Arizona and in many states. We're going to talk about that in a few moments. And that's the kind of thing we're asking you about. The social safety net has holes in it. Where are they in your neighborhood? How are you feeling the situation right now? Are there signs that the safety net is working for you or not? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, let's check in on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. As we've been hearing, the latest employment numbers are better than expected, a lot better. The Labor Department says the nation's unemployment rate fell to 10%, down from 10.2%. 11,000 jobs were lost last month, and that's far fewer than expected. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, spoke to the Takeaway this morning. She said the department was well positioned to prevent any terrorist attack from inside or outside America, and she was clearly supportive of President Obama's surge strategy in Afghanistan. We asked her how much of a backstop her department will be when U.S. forces finally leave Afghanistan.
I don't think we can rely on one federal government department to take care of all of our security needs. It is going to be a shared responsibility across the country. And if there's anything I hope to work on and improve over the next several years, it's that notion of shared responsibility and really having everybody lean forward into this.
You can hear the full interview with Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano by going to thetakeaway.org.
And staying with Afghanistan, NATO's committed an extra 7,000 troops to the war effort there this morning. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton is at a NATO conference in Brussels. And finally, we end with some great news for political reporters who follow the president. They'll be headed to Hawaii for the holidays. Here's Bing Crosby to set the mood for you.
Melikilikimaka is a thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day.
Yeah, maybe not so lovely if you're in the filing center, but the president and the first family will be saying Malia Kalikimaka.
Melikalikimaka.
Thank you, Celeste. That's how you say Merry Christmas in Hawaii.
That's right.
According to the Honolulu Star Bulletin, the president and his family will be spending Christmas holidays in Hawaii, where the president grew up. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
This morning, all morning long, we're talking about the social safety net. These are programs that are designed to save families, save individuals when events occur in their lives that remove their support systems. Earlier, we talked about unemployment funds in several states running out. And now we're talking about childcare programs. The new monthly unemployment numbers were released for the month of November. The jobless rate dropped to 10%. Employers shed 11,000 jobs. But regardless of those new unemployment numbers, the safety net across the United States has already been damaged. There are already holes. And we're going to take a look at one place where there's a large hole. That's in Arizona. There's a crisis brewing there. Poor families with children are bearing a lot of the brunt. This week, Arizona hit a grim milestone. The state there has now turned away the 10,000th child from a program that helps their parents pay for daycare. It gives them a $350 subsidy. We're joined now by Bruce Liggett. He's the executive director of the Arizona Child Care Association. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
Tell us exactly what this program does. It essentially allows working parents to go to work, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Since the early 80s, the state has helped low-income working families with a subsidy for the portion of the cost of child care. Child care is expensive, and it should be. It's the care of our young children. But low-income families just can't afford it without some help.
So at the same time that we're asking families to do more to support themselves, in other words, programs like Medicaid and food stamps are being cut, we're also taking away the programs that allow them to get to work.
That's right. Several years ago, we in this country reformed welfare and sent a message that work was important. But what we did was give states flexibility to rearrange instead of welfare payments to be able to provide work supports like childcare. What's happening now is that commitment to provide those supports is eroding.
Okay, we're going to go now to Sandra Hanner. She's the director of Akiti's Kingdom Daycare Facility in Arizona. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning.
You're seeing this play out in your workplace. Can you tell me, are there parents coming in and having to remove their kids from your daycare program because of this?
Oh, definitely. Every week it's somebody new that has asked to speak with me directly and express that they are having to take their children out of our facility because they can no longer afford childcare. And with the tears, these are parents that have been with us for years, but they're on a waiting list that in months they're told that they would be lifted, and still 6 months later they're still on this waiting list and they cannot continue to pay.
Well, we're going to talk about that waiting list, how it's not really a waiting list, in just a moment. But first, tell me, what do these parents tell you? I mean, what options do they have? Are they saying that they now have to stay home and take care of the kids themselves? Do we now have, 13-year-old siblings watching these children? What happens when they remove their kids from your program?
Exactly. We now have boyfriends watching children that are unrelated to them, or we have family members that are watching them. And frankly, we even have children that are being left unattended.
Okay, that's Sandra Hanner. She's the director of Akiti's Kingdom Daycare Facility. Bruce Liggett, you're the executive director of the Arizona Child Care Association. You heard Sandra referring to people sitting on this waiting list. And as I said, we have 10,000 people on this waiting list now. But is this really a waiting list? Are they eventually going to get into the program?
It's unlikely. The term waiting list is really benign, and what we've been trying to point out is the very nature of child care assistance is that people need help when they have a job offer. They're coming into state offices every day saying, I have a job starting on Monday and I need child care. To be put on some list, which is really a turnaway list, that says maybe in a year you'll get care, maybe you'll never get care, it's just a misnomer. And what is happening is people are not able to take those jobs, going on welfare, or leaving their kids alone.
unattended, as Sandra was talking about.
That's right.
Sandra, you yourself, this is actually becoming a vicious circle, because these child care cuts are forcing parents to take their kids out of your daycare facility, and that's forcing you to lay off some of your employees.
Yes, every eighth child that we lose is one teacher that I'm going to have to let go. And then they now then are in this vicious cycle of the unemployment rates. They're now a statistic.
And what are the options for these parents? Are there other places, Bruce Liggett of the Arizona Child Care Association, are there other organizations that are stepping in and offering to cover this gap?
No, there was an organization locally here who provided some temporary scholarships in the summer, but those are over. So today there's no other options for families, really. You're looking at patchwork arrangements that are not stable in terms of what they need for their jobs, or are unsafe for their children, or not going to work and going on welfare.
We're used to, Sandra, we're used to people having options. We're used to them getting turned away from one place and finding another place that will at least help them, right? Are these parents coming to you and saying that they're shocked that there's no other place to turn, that they have to give up their job?
That they're actually having to give up their job to stay home.
Yeah, they're surprised.
Completely surprised. And there's so many questions, and they're coming to us thinking that we have the answers, and we just don't.
Bruce Liggett, how is this going to be solved in Arizona? Is it?
Well, what we need is for our elected officials to step up and recognize that our short-term crisis, we've got a really severe budget problem. So, there's tough decisions being made in Arizona. We've got one of the worst economies in the country.
The second worst budget deficit.
That's right. And so, these aren't easy decisions, but people need to recognize that child care is an investment that pays off, that it's keeping people working. They're earning money. They're not going on welfare. They're paying taxes. It's rippling through our economy by supporting the child care workforce. So this is not an area to cut in an economic downturn. This is when you need investments to get people back to work.
Okay, that's Bruce Liggett. He's the executive director of the Arizona Child Care Association. And Sandra Hanna joined us. She's the director of Akiti's Kingdom Daycare Facility, one of the oldest daycare facilities in Arizona. Thanks to both of you.
So if you have a story about struggling with child care and not finding help, you can tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how you can reach us. We're talking about unemployment, and we need your eyes. Tell us, how have you seen the unemployment story play out in your town?
Larry writes us, I live in the Detroit area. I work just west of the city. My shop is located along a major east-west rail line. I've noticed a real upswing in rail traffic recently, with many of the trains pulling fully loaded rail cars full of new cars. Traffic of finished steel coil cars have also been increasing. Unscientific evidence that things are picking up, I know, but nonetheless, one that I think shows some hope. Let us know about your social safety net and how things look at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley, not filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.